everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, dear listeners. Sorry to be away. Excited to be back with you.
And on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, great to be with you. Sorry I didn't visit with you two in New York City. I was home and you guys were traveling.
We did find each other.
I'm at the airport and I see Shireen. I say, where are you headed? She goes, New York. And I'm like, we're on the same flight. And then we got there and I said, come with me. Let's take transit into the city. And she followed me and it was fun.
And I retraced our steps. I think
it's not a bad way
good.
To get into town, right?
Yeah.
And I got a picture, so it happened, right?
That's all good. John, could you tell that Shireen has got a little bit of energy in her today?
Just a little spicy.
We're just talking about some issues, and she seemed loaded for bear here. So let's just see how this goes. Let's keep it nice, guys.
This is where we duck and cover.
Yeah, I will just say, we are in the last 2 weeks of the legislative session, and you know, it's really a miracle any of us get here with our like core, you know, sense of self intact, considering the way the attacks keep coming. But it is quite an active session. I hope we speak about that.
Yeah, which means the second part of our program will be a little bit more spicy. But let's do some global and national news.
For the big picture session, we're recording on Monday. There's essentially 2 weeks left. So by the time listeners hear this on Thursday,
so basically one week left.
Yeah, okay. Well, so I want to start out with the Mexican security forces killing this drug lord. That has created havoc in our neighbor to the south. My goodness, the pictures I've seen and the way that airports have been sort of shut down, roads, burning cars.
I did not have this on my bingo card for 2026. This was not something I expected this weekend.
All the people that are vacationing to Mexico all of a sudden kind of got nerves about it, different things. But really, it sounds like, Shireen, that Mexico and the U.S. work jointly on this.
It does sound like Mexico and the U.S. work together on this, which is good, right? Mm-hmm. We need to have that kind of coordination around activities like this. It is absolutely, I'm hearing from folks, just seeing different people posting on vacation mm-hmm. to Mexico, suddenly seeing
shelter in place.
Yeah. So it's very, very scary. And then I think it does, like, that's kind of the surface of it, right? But it creates this, like, deeper level of disruption and potential mm-hmm. kind of spill out violence associated with something like this. But ultimately, a good thing.
Well, and you just hope that there's not some unraveling, you know.
Correct.
So like it's good for the Mexican government to get on top of drug lords, meaning, you know, to rein down.
And the violence that they've had over the decades.
Yeah, you got to do it. And yet it can unravel.
Yeah.
Now, the same thing, John, can happen in the Middle East. I'm doing an economic presentation this week, and they use this term geonomics for geopolitical economics, geonomics. And I was looking at the number of warships stationed near Iran right now.
Iran. You did it.
I did it. John, what do you see in there? Because this is something that could unravel for the president, or it could work out.
Yeah. So this is the question. Is he really intending to use these? Mm-hmm. Or is this a negotiating strategy? Put pressure, put the warships right out there off the coast and basically dare them to provoke him.
Yeah. Shireen, we have the USS Gerald Ford, the USS Abraham Lincoln. These are aircraft carriers. We've got, I think it was like a half dozen destroyers.
Yeah. Yeah. And major ongoing political unrest inside of Iran. Many seeing that this may be, it's hard to say because it feels like I've been doing this show a long time and there have been many challenges to the existing regime. And there's real belief that this could be the tipping point. I think there's a real difference between something that is happening inside of the country that spurs regime change and something that happens externally that brings that forward.
I liked the president's quote where he said, they can't have a nuclear weapon. It's very simple. You can't have peace in the Middle East if they have a nuclear weapon.
He's also the president that pulled us out of the JCPOA. So we had tools to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon, which he blew up.
Okay, fair enough.
And on the Sunday talk shows, a spokesperson for Iran was talking about this is only about nuclear materials. This is not about broader missiles and other things like that. So he's trying to make the case that they have a human right to develop peaceful nuclear materials for energy and so forth. And there's somewhat skepticism about really, is that the case? Can you not buy it elsewhere?
John and Shireen, former Governor Mike Huckabee, this is of Arkansas. It's confusing because his daughter is now governor and all those sorts of things. But Mike Huckabee is now, if I understand it, the ambassador to Israel for the United States. If I got this right, always correct me if I'm wrong. But he's in an interaction with Tucker Carlson. And he's basically asked if Israel is entitled, according to Huckabee's literal interpretation of biblical scripture, to claim much of the modern Middle East. Now, you have to know that Huckabee's a very religious man. I think a former, I don't know, ecclesiastical leader.
That's pastor or something like that.
If I remember right. Anyway, Huckabee responded and said it would be fine if they took it all.
Yeah, how'd that sit with you, Natalie?
Of course, he had to walk that back moments later.
Yeah, I just thought it was unfortunate, not helpful. I've been at the Israel ambassador's home. It used to be in Tel Aviv. Now they moved it to Jerusalem, so I don't know how it is now. But I've been to the former home or current home, if they still have it in Tel Aviv. And I just have this visual of that relationship between the U.S. and Israel and how important it is that we have voices of peace rather than voices of conflict. This felt like it was pushing towards conflict.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Am I reading that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is where I find statements like this incredibly frustrating, I guess, to say the least. I think that it does create that sort of insight into the ideologies that are guiding what this administration believes about the Middle East.
Yeah. John, Board of Peace. President Trump had his first inaugural meeting of this alternative to the United Nations called the Board of Peace.
Where he talked about war with Iran.
Yeah, well, yeah. And he says the U.S. is going to give $10 billion in funding to this.
Oh, I anticipate we'll give a lot more than $10 billion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and behind all of it is this idea to turn Gaza into this seaside resort, this upscale, you know, I'll call it Riviera.
Yeah, which is what they've been promoting and which he will profit from directly.
Yeah. Where do you think this goes, John?
Which, the development or the Board of Peace?
Both, because the way I'm thinking of it is that this president finishes in, you know, 2.5-3 years, and then this kind of dies.
I think it's his platform to try and position for peace, you know, whether he wants to declare it or whether it's actual peace that takes place. He's going to use this as his vehicle to drive that. He looks at, you know, NATO and the UN and stuff and thinks they're largely ineffective. So this becomes his vehicle as the chair to drive the agenda that he thinks is important. I think a lot of countries will participate because they will feel that
pressure to be part of this. And my point is that the force of personality will go away when he's no longer president. So I have seen that shift of power before, that mantle go from one shoulder to another. I mean, it's in small levels, but I saw it when Mike Leavitt resigned as governor and it went to Lean Walker. And I'm telling you, it is real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Meaning all of a sudden this dean of governors, the most senior governor in the country at the time, Mike Leavitt, had less cachet in the governor's office because everyone started turning to the next governor.
Yeah.
It was really fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
There's a mantle of leadership. And I don't think it'll go with President Trump when he's done.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, you mentioned people feeling that some of these large international collaborations around peace or whatever it may be are ineffectual. The Board of Peace will be that. I mean, times 100, right? There is no structure by which this was created with consent of nations. This is his idea, and he will use it to continue his grift as long as he can.
I mentioned to you.
I think there'll be a lot in terms of the development. I think there'll be a lot of conflict about the development. I mean, some may see it as beneficial and this is better for the Gazans. Others will say this is not what they want. This is not benefiting them. And perhaps it might even be pushing them away from their homeland. So,
yeah, I think
there'll be a lot of challenges there.
We've got one more bit of news that might be interesting to our listeners. This is going to the EPA, where the Trump administration is preparing to roll back limits on toxic mercury pollution from coal-fired power plants. This reminds us of what we recently saw with the rollback of greenhouse gas emission regulation. You know, when I worked at EPA, we were the first administration to start to deal with mercury at coal-fired power plants. I sat through hours and hours of briefings on mercury. I have a file at home, a binder. I'm holding up my fingers for the listeners, about 4 inches thick of all this science on mercury. And basically what happens is, you know, these coal-fired power plants, mostly from China, by the way, put this up in the air and then it drops into the oceans and bioaccumulates and ends up in our tuna fish.
Yeah.
It's in tuna fish sandwiches. That's children, by the way. I don't think this is a good idea to roll back protections of mercury in our food.
Uh-huh. And I see a difference. I totally agree with you when it comes to mercury. Okay. I have a different opinion on some of the greenhouse gas restrictions that were put in place, but I totally see the concern for mercury.
I want regulation. I just want to be smart. And I like market-based regulation like we do with acid rain, you know, where we use a market and where the places where you can have the greatest impact incentivized through the market to take take hold of it. But
well, the market's one way to approach it. Yeah, I think there could be a moral obligation.
You like command and control better, Shereen.
I will say I it's interesting that we all agree on this Mercury issue. I feel like there are one of the other big things, I guess, if we want to take it from a more capitalist perspective. There is just huge chaos created when we have these regulations come in and go out, come in and go out. And when I ran for Congress, I think one of the things that I learned was what industries really want to see, what folks are looking for, and besides making money, of course, is that stability. Mm-hmm. It allows for prediction. It allows for planning. It really impacts decisions that are made.
So go ahead, John.
No, I was just going to say, I come from the perspective of, I don't think I have a right to harm you. Mm-hmm. And yet the government steps in when it comes to a lot of environmental regulations and instead says, this is how much I'm allowed to harm you. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my concerns, that libertarian side of me coming out going, this is the government saying, here's the permission of what you can and can't do, rather than saying, no, you can't harm others.
Yeah. Well, so in our next segment, we have to talk about tariffs and the Supreme Court decision. So we'll go there next.
Sounds good.
Stay tuned, everybody. It's Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and John Dougal.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We'd love to hear from our listeners like you. If you'd like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Once again, that's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. John and Shereen, I was up on Capitol Hill last week. I'm just in a conversation with someone.
Here or D.C.?
At the top of State Street in Salt Lake City. And a group of school kids passed by, and this school teacher kind of pops, over to say to me, hey, I'm a listener of Both Sides of the Aisle. I love the program. And then he walked off. And I was like, how did you know that was me?
Well, 5 minutes later, he said that to me.
Okay.
I was really scoring
on Capitol Hill.
I was doing a mock debate with students there. And he came up to me and said, I just saw Natalie. And, he came to me,
goodness.
Too.
How does he know what we look like?
He went and researched our pictures.
That's so great. Well, anyway, thanks for listening.
Yeah.
And stalking us on.
And thanks for educating our kids.
Yeah. And props for being a school teacher and helping out. Well, we got to talk about this Supreme Court decision. This was a major blow to the president. This is a 6-3 ruling. That was the number one thing I wanted to know, is how did it break down? But they struck down President Trump's global tariffs. Boy, did
under IEEPA.
Yeah, this emergency powers.
Yeah.
Not the other ones, but those under emergency powers.
Boy, did President Trump lash back.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Who's disloyal? Constitution?
Yeah, and he started chatting about, you're under foreign influence and
lapdogs.
Lapdogs, words like that.
How does this work? The logic of it was really lost on me. But I think what's important here, right, is that this issue has been going back to, what is happening in the global markets. This is not good, though my understanding is after this decision came, there was a good spike in the markets, right? Mm-hmm. People liked to see this. Trump immediately came out and said it was going to be 10% tariffs across everything then. Then it was going to be 15. And I think what's so frustrating about this, of course, I'm like, you do you, boo, because we hate this. The American people do not like what you are doing on tariffs. The Supreme Court just tried to save you from your most unpopular, one of your most, I think ICE is probably the most unpopular immigration right now, but they tried to save you from this. Mm-hmm. Take a win. But no, he's doubling down.
Well, he's a tariff guy, so he believes intimately,
favorite word,
passionately in tariffs. Tariffs will save America is what he believes.
What he believes.
And so therefore, he's going all in. But to me, it's like, okay, what does the Constitution say? And I get that three dissenters basically were coming from the perspective regulate trade includes the ability to levy tariffs. I'm hard-pressed to see that. And so this is one of those things which basically this is just saying it wasn't really as much about tariffs.
Yeah.
It was what they call the major questions doctrine, which is when Congress speaks and delegates authority, it does so clearly. It doesn't do it vaguely. So, to say for 50 years, none of those presidents have been smart enough to impose tariffs under IEEPA. And look, I can, but it's unclear. It's like,
and
IEEPA
doesn't use the word tariffs and things like that.
No, correct.
Well, this is going to be interesting because what it does is creates more uncertainty.
Yep.
More chaos. And it really raises the question.
And pushes back to Congress, to say, do your job. If you want to delegate, delegate clearly.
Is my number right? I don't see it anywhere in front of me, but isn't it about something where just shy of $140 billion that have been collected in tariffs. Am I getting that number right?
I think it might be a little bit higher, but you're in the ballpark.
And that's money you paid, listeners.
Yeah, this is where I'm coming from. Shireen, what do you think happens to that money? Do you think it just stays in the federal treasury? Do you think it goes back to business? Do you think it goes to consumers? Is Costco going to give you a little kickback?
Right. I mean, I think this is what happens when we elect someone who is supremely unqualified to lead in absolutely every single way. Not just the fact that he is completely fine harassing and, well, I mean, he's in the Epstein files, like thousands and thousands of times, right? Like, we know what kind of person of character this is. But on top of that, he is a bad and failed businessman. He's a good brand marketer, but he is not a strategic leader. Mm-hmm. And what we are learning now, I mean, this goes across every single facet of how he has decided to govern. He just tries things and there is no answer. So we all just gave our money now to, I guess, him, like to the federal government. And there is no plan.
I'm not at all an expert on this, but if I were in Congress, I would get a bill written that basically says what you do with that money.
Send it back.
Well, and I might be different. I might keep 50% in the treasury. I might give a certain percentage back to corporations, small businesses, and then I might give a little kickback to the taxpayer.
I think
something that just makes it clear.
I think those who paid the tariffs are going to want to say it's refunded to us, and they're going to be lining up in the courts to petition the courts.
Who paid them, John? Who paid them? How do you answer that question?
Well, the records show that the company or the individual who actually directly paid the tariff is the one who should receive it back.
Yeah, but my economics training would say that where the legal liability is isn't where the economic liability is.
Right,
and so a consumer may have paid it even though a company has the legal liability.
Right, but I'm telling you, companies are going to be lining up to make sure that gets refunded back to them because they directly paid it.
It's going
to
be interesting.
But the federal government is not going to do favors. I don't think they're going to just wake up and say, hey, guess what, everybody, just submit this form and we'll refund it. I think they're going to force the courts to opine on whether or not it needs to be refunded.
Yeah. All right, let's shift to local.
Okay.
We got our answer on these signature packets for the Republican-backed Utahns for Representative Government. Looks like they got their number, John.
They're getting close to their number. I haven't seen that they've actually reached the number, but they're getting pretty darn close.
And what you're meaning, they sent in a bunch, but
they
have to be certified.
Over 200,000 signatures, and so they have to. The county clerks have to review those signatures.
They have to get validate 141,000 some odd.
And they have to get 8% in, I think it's 26 of 29 Senate districts.
And that, I think, my prediction is that's where they're going to lose this. The numbers are not looking great right now for the distribution.
I predict they have it. I think they have it.
They have the signatures.
But I think they even have the 26 of 29
maybe.
And they're legit signatures.
You may be right, but let me throw in the little catch.
Okay.
There are 45 days or so for the opponents to get people to remove their names.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I anticipate they're not going to go after places like Washington County. They're going to go after Salt Lake County and a few of those that are right on the bubble, even those that maybe are a little more conservative but are just barely over the threshold, to try and get them under the threshold. Because all they got to do is get it down to 25 counties.
That's
and
right.
And boom.
It's off. Yep.
Super interesting. Okay. Then we got the maps. We got the Supreme Court rejecting the legislature's effort to undo the state's new congressional map.
This is our Utah Supreme Court
now. Supreme Court. This is our Chief Justice, Matthew Durant. You're the attorney. John, walk us through what happened here.
No, I'm not playing an attorney on the radio, but my understanding of what took place here is basically the Utah Supreme Court, three-judge panel, I guess, said you missed the filing. You had a 30-day window and you failed. Now, I know there are going to be various folks that are very upset about that. One of the things I kept hearing out of the November ruling from the district judge is she didn't issue a final order. So we can't appeal something that's not appealable yet. So to then get burned and said you missed the deadline of 30 days, that's going to really irritate a lot of folks.
What's the deal with the federal judges rejecting the lawmakers' bid to toss these congressional maps?
I did not have a chance to really read that opinion. I thought it came out today, but it was along the lines of it's too late in the process to overturn the apple cart or disrupt the election process.
Yeah, and so this map that our judge put forward is the map that we'll be using in the election in November.
It would be it feels like very few paths continue to exist.
That is where we currently sit, and that is an outrage from my perspective. As I've said before, I thought it was highly improper for the district judge to draw a map, to adopt a map. Highly improper.
I probably shouldn't go down this route.
For her to reject the legislative map, I could see arguments for that. But to then take the next step to adopt a map of a not the legislature, not the commission, somebody else.
I get the point. It was interesting. We had Representative Owens in here. He sat in the chair you're in, John, and he basically said when his dad was in Congress that they wanted to make a change on these boundaries. But Senator Garn was the guy that said, no, we need a Democrat back there. It helps us to have somebody in, you know, the room with the Democrats negotiate on behalf of Utah. And there was an actual effort for the good of our state to, like, keep this Salt Lake County version of the maps in place. I just thought it was interesting. I thought our listeners might find that interesting.
Yeah. If you haven't listened to the, I mean, I hope you enjoyed those episodes that we put in for you. But I did think it was a really interesting conversation. And I do think that we have a benefit when we have folks advocate who can advocate for us no matter who is in power, right?
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting because, John, your point is that this is a, you know, a very gerrymandered, you know, district because it favors Democrats. And this was Senator Garn saying, actually, that's actually okay for the state.
Well,
which is just an interesting point of view.
The concern I have is it's not gerrymandered, but it absolutely is gerrymandered. And to say it was done without partisan data, the partisan data is baked into it.
Just like
and
the maps
so,
were
therefore,
before.
Therefore, it's a fiction to me.
Yeah, I totally get your point. Okay, I think we ought to talk about the session a little bit. Our legislators
and
got...
And Representative Owens was not Burgess Owens.
So. No.
Yeah.
Doug.
Just to be clear to our listeners, it was a different
Our legislature
time.
Got news about how much money they have, $750 million in new state tax revenues over the next two fiscal years. This was after a loss of $300 million that came out of the One Big Beautiful Bill. This is still a prosperous state that continues to grow, continues to have money in state coffers, but it still ends up being a tighter year.
Mm-hmm. It ends up being a tighter year. Why do we have that kind of... I mean, that's more than they were anticipating. Mm-hmm. Why do we have that?
Go ahead.
You go.
The very first thing from my perspective, not the economist in the room, but back in November, in preparation for the governor's budget, they do a joint revenue forecast. And they usually want to be a little more conservative with that because they don't want the legislature waking up in February with the final stages of budgeting going, oh, we have less money than we thought. They would rather have a little bit more money than less money.
Yeah.
And so they're a little more cautious in November.
I think the statement that was put out that says Utah families are working, businesses are expanding, our economy remains resilient, it captures it pretty well, Shereen. And, and the way I would just add a little bit of color commentary is that we have a very low unemployment rate. Our economy is growing at about twice the national rate. You know, people are gainfully employed in this state and they're paying taxes.
Yes. So I'll just add to that, though, that we also have numbers of uninsured Utahns are exploding. Thousands of people have lost care and they're unable to afford it through the ACA. In the conversation I had with Sophia DeCaro, I mentioned that the state said that it's no longer going to fund a food program for kids. It was $13 million federal money that we used to rely on. I'm sitting here looking at this number, $750 million in new state tax revenue over the next two fiscal years, and we can't figure out how to keep people on Medicaid or to feed our children. So to me, it's just such a moral bankruptcy when I look at that number and think about the fact that, yes, we are seeing this kind of growth, but we continue to fail those among us that have the very least. And I find that really frustrating.
Yeah, I follow you. Hey, we also have Representative Tyler Clancy. He's got HB 29.
Are we going to talk about the tax cuts?
I mean,
legislature is looking to do another modest
tax cut. Okay, yeah, this is fair. This is our good friend, Senator Dan McKay, helping get us a lower rate.
You know, when I ran the Huntsman tax reform bill and set the rate at 5%, I was pushing for something less than that. So it's nice to see us getting down to the 4.5%.
Yeah. And
it's a little.
And Senator McKay wants us to get to 4.45.
Yep. Yep.
Shereen,
you
smug
me.
Over it.
I'm just like, here we go. Child care is unaffordable. People can't get into housing. How
have
many
you
people
ever
are on the disability wait list?
That part of our economic success is because we're a good place to do business? And
I do think that, but I also think that what
low
that allows
rates?
Us, what that should allow us to do is to take care of our neighbors and not rely on volunteers or churches to step up and do that. I think as we have a group of people in the state that are becoming more secular, that the state has to reckon with the fact that what we need to do is invest in social services, not continue to cut them.
Yeah.
Oh, and I would partly disagree with you because the more you weaken community ties and just says the government's going to take care of it, I think that causes problems down the road.
I think that's a lack of vision for what it could mean to create
Well, I think it's a lack of vision to say the government needs to be the provider of all these services.
They can certainly fund it. They can certainly fund it, and you can still show up and do it. I mean, my husband works goes out and does Meals on Wheels. Those meals are getting smaller and smaller. Those seniors are getting fewer and fewer calories every single week. And that is something that the state could do something about.
All right, you two, 30 seconds. I got to do Representative Clancy's bill, HB 29. This is a bill that gets rid of all the hidden charges in rentals and other industries, passed unanimously through the House. I think this is a good bill. I'm proud of Representative Clancy.
I think it's good, too. I'm with it. Oh, but you like it.
I'm one of those. What is the market failing at, and why doesn't the market take care of this?
Because you get information failure.
Because I also bring up who's
markets
the worst,
fail when
who's
you don't
the worst
have information.
With hidden fees? The sales tax.
John, get rid of the entire sales tax. Hey, let's end the program. But thank you, everybody. What a great conversation. Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shringer Bonney. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.